Hello and welcome to episode 15 of the SRA podcast. This is your host, as always, Alex Yumba. And joining me this week for this just ever descending train wreck into the hell world is our very own JL. He is back once more on the show.
Howdy. We
scared him off for a little while, but he has returned. So, hello.
Howdy, how are you?
Oh, you know, podcasting day. All sorts of podcasts. I just got done with an interview with the Hampton Institute, and now I'm doing this. And then I will most likely be doing the Patreon special episode tonight. So, just a fun day of audio visual experiences all around.
Just saw the Hampton Institute thing. Congrats on that.
It was a very, very good discussion. I'll post a link for it for the listeners. It was very... Very good interview, I think. As always, looking in retrospect, I could have said things differently, but that's how it's always going to be. You can always think of better things in retrospect. So, we'll get the show started this week with today's breaking news. So, as listeners might have been able to deduce via extensive forensic research of past episodes, I record this on Wednesdays so that I can have it done by Friday. And this Wednesday, we have a story about pipe bombs. So, you know, everyone's favorite anarchist cookbook equipment. I personally do not like bombs, so let this be on the record, Internet. I'm Alex Humva, not approving of bombs. Especially not approving...
It's a really brave position.
I know. It's just putting myself out there for all people to heckle me for. But yes, unfortunately... This is no joking matter. Pipe bombs were sent to numerous individuals. So they were sent to Hillary Clinton. Technically, I think it was Hillary and Bill, because I know the news has reported this as two former presidents. So I think it was their shared residence that it was sent to, as well as former President Barack Obama. Things were sent to CNN.
Don't forget George Soros.
George Soros as well. Checks. Yes, don't blow up George Soros. I need my checks. I keep calling his helpline because I need that check. I need to make rent. Gotta pay that rent. So, need my Soros check for my rent. Yeah, bunch of people got the pipe bomb treatment. None of them have exploded, thankfully. There are no injuries that I've heard of at this point about coming out of this. It looks like they were all duds, which goes to show you, bombs are very tricky things. And vast majority of times, it's actually very difficult to make things explode. It's amazing, but making
there was a guy on Twitter who was saying that you know, maybe the intent was just to make it look like a bomb, you know, just to do a little scare. He said that, you know, had this been you know, a well-intentioned bombing, it probably would have been successful. But most of the time in his career, he's seen that most people are just trying to, you know, scare their political enemies or whoever it is that they're threatening.
Yeah, I could see that it's probably, if it had been a more asserted effort, it looks like what I'm reading here, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 bombs, 5 bombs is what I'm getting from this, at least, that were sent out, more being discovered throughout the day, as it were. So there might be some more drifting out there in the postal system right now. If you are a postal worker listening to this at work, since I know podcasts are a big thing in the postal community, definitely be careful with the packages you handle. Could be something weird in there. Don't want to get hurt doing your job. So it looks like, if at least 5 confirmed at this point, you know, that's even a pretty hefty failure rate, would think that one of them would have gone off, but so it probably is trying to send the message. It's one of those things, you know, we don't know who did this yet, of course. It's going to be an ongoing investigation to figure out who it is, and I'm sure we'll find something. The Postal Service takes its job very seriously, and those Postal Service investigators are wizards when it comes to tracking things back through the mail. So we'll no doubt be aware of who this individual is in the near future, hopefully. But it is evidence of the times, and it is evidence of, you know, one of the people that was sent to was actually our Maxine Waters, Representative Maxine Waters of Congress. And, you know, it's one of those things that people are going to, of course, it's already happening on conservative and right-wing media outlets and social media of, well, you know, the left was asking for this, you know, Representative Waters, she was asking for this, calling for agitation and calling for all this disobedience, you know, so they were just asking for it. And of course, you know, who has the left threatened to bomb? Who has the left sent bombs to? Who has the left put up sniper nests to oversee protests? Who has the left kicked people's ribs in? And this is, it's one of those things that, of course, the right-wing news media can't accept that there is obviously somebody with an agenda and obviously somebody with a very right-leaning slant that's attacking supposed leftists. You know, they think Clinton and Obama and Soros and Waters and CNN are these communist, leftist, socialist, Marxist whatevers that they're out to destroy America, when, of course, they are a different side of the same coin. That Clinton, of all people, is no socialist. I think we can all agree upon that. But of course,
that's a really good point.
But of course, the right can't make that distinction.
Well, yeah, and I think what you just said would be great. You know, if I were working at the FBI, you know, it's very obvious what the MO is here. So I think, you know, if I were an FBI agent and I was looking at this case, I would not be pointing my finger at an actual leftist. I'd be pointing my finger at some, I don't know, someone who gets their news from these very disturbed kind of corners of the internet, or, you know, maybe just some older person that, you know, is just very into like Tucker Carlson or something, you know, someone who has an idea about what the left is that isn't actually rooted in reality.
Exactly. And I mean, it's one of those things that I suspect this will only be the beginning, unfortunately. And, you know, this time around, those bombs didn't go off. It was just a message. I can't be so certain next time that the right isn't going to try something like that. I can't be so certain that we aren't going to have a Timothy McVeigh, which, you know, in the same way that conservatives will try to portray Hitler as a leftist because, don't you know, National Socialist, that's what the Nazis were. Which, you know, just, I won't even grace that with the airtime to explain why that's so bullshit. But it's the same thing of I've seen in recent times right-wing media trying to portray Timothy McVeigh as this leftist domestic terrorist, when obviously the dude was very much right-leaning, very much in this libertarian school of thought. He was doing it in response to Waco. Was one of the reasons why he committed the Oklahoma City bombings. So this is what we see, though, that these domestic terrorists so often are these very far right, very conservative individuals, and it's something I can only see continuing, because as the right becomes more and more hysterical, and more pushed further and further to the extreme by people like Donald Trump, who, you know, a lot of people give him, I think, too much credit. I don't think he's orchestrating some master plan to overthrow the United States government, and he's orchestrating it with Putin and, you know, all these things. I don't think Trump's a mastermind. I just think he knows marketing, because that's the one thing he knows, is how to market. And far-right ideology is just so marketable right now, unfortunately. And it's becoming more and more normalized. The various comments him and other members of the Republican Party have made, that as time progresses, if they think Clinton, of all people, the barely neoliberal, frankly conservative outlooks Clinton has, of all people, and they think that's a flaming leftist, then what does that say about the rest of us? And certainly,
well, that's a really good point. When I actually attended a Trump rally just to see what that was going to be like. He came to Macon, Georgia. It was very early on in his campaign, and I was I think I was mostly taken aback by the way that he used the crowd. is very interesting. There was a moment where he was talking about these protesters that were holding signs up in the front. Now, I was basically as close to the stage as I could be. I put some photos up on my Twitter. But, you know, I was surrounded by these guys that were chanting "lock her up." And Trump took notice and he said, you know, should we, you know, maybe not go so hard on Clinton? You know, that's a bit unfair. And he started getting boos from the crowd. You know, the crowd just was like, no, we should go as hard as we possibly can on Hillary, you know, lock her up, lock her up. And he seemed almost reluctant to go along with it. But because the crowd was, you know, corralling him in that direction, then he was like, all right, yeah, we'll be tough. It was really weird. He did that a number of times throughout the night where he just kind of asked the crowd what his opinion should be. And then, you know, if he got booed, then he would just change his opinion. And, I think that's where, I don't know, he's in many ways the combination of his constituents' like innermost desires. It's like he's not really a person unto himself, but more a voice for the hive mind. It's very strange.
Yeah, it is kind of weird looking at Trump, because of course Trump changes his opinion whenever it suits him, and it's so often to the crowd. I mean, it's a joke at this point. You can find a tweet, any Trump tweet you can find its opposite that he once tweeted, and it has become normalized. That is exactly the problem, though, that it's become normalized. We just accept this as a fact of life now, and that's how these things build, that what is abnormal today will be normal tomorrow, which means the new fringe will simply be abnormal. And then the process repeats over and over and over again until we get to these extremes. And we can see right now, looking out at the world, we can see right now what's going on. That we have Brazil, the very scary situation in Brazil, that their far-right candidate is talking about a purge. After he is elected, he's talking about purging all leftists of the country, out of the government.
There were a number of people who messaged the national Twitter account to say that they were in Brazil and that things were really tense and, you know, they were going to be keeping things on the down low from now on. And, you know, it's a very scary situation, but it was nice to see that, you know, people were still brave in that respect, that they were, I don't know, keeping to their wits and, you know, acknowledging the situation for what it was. Solidarity to all of our Brazilian comrades.
Absolutely. All the solidarity and support that we can give them, and we have to make sure that people are aware of what's going on there. We have to make sure that the world is aware of what's going on, because if that election doesn't go well, then, I mean, I don't think it's going to go well either way, because at the same time, this guy's got out and said that he's not even going to honor, you know, an election where he doesn't win. And wouldn't you think that kind of sounds familiar to us? And the only difference, I think, is that in 2016...
What do you think's going to happen in 2020?
I don't even know what's going to happen in 2020. I did see, you know, one morning this week, I woke up and I looked at my Twitter and I saw that a top Clinton campaigner is saying that she is very seriously considering 2020. I went straight back to bed because I can't deal with that in my life. And I don't know what I'm going to do if it's Clinton versus Trump again, because the Democratic Party has not fundamentally changed since 2016. They have undergone no soul searching. They have undergone no journey through the desert, as it were. They've just buckled down on exactly what lost them of the election. That the entire election was, I'm not Trump, I'm not Trump, I'm not Trump. Anytime somebody questioned or criticized anything the Clinton campaign had to say, well, obviously you are a dirty Trump supporter. It's absolute insanity to me that this party has not undergone any significant change. The closest thing to it is that, you know, because of Bernie Sanders' success and the rise of the DSA, now the DSA is endorsing, you know, slightly more leftist social democratic candidates, but there is nobody who's come up yet and espoused truly socialistic ideas within the Democratic Party. There are no candidates that have won primaries. I'm not even aware of many people who have stood challenge in these primaries with honest, far-left, proper socialist ideas.
Meanwhile, Trump is now saying that he's a nationalist. And although it's an old-timey phrase that's out of favor, he wants his constituents to call themselves nationalists. And he went on a weird tirade, you know, railing against the globalists. I mean, we know what that means. It's a dog whistle. And you know, I wonder to what extent that he even knows what he's talking about. I mean, again, I don't know that necessarily that he's a mastermind of any kind, but he surrounds some people. He surrounds himself with people who, like Steve Bannon, have these very fascist ideologies. So, you know, I do wonder if he's going to, if there's going to be an issue in 2020, you know, if it's Trump versus anyone, you know, maybe the Democratic Party does run someone who's more in line with what I believe are winning policies now and progressive ideas from socialist candidates. What happens if Trump loses the election? Does he leave the White House? This is something I'm seriously wondering. You know, there's the comment he made the 2016 election about widespread voter fraud from illegal immigrants. And although these are just not backed up statements, I wonder if he could play his base to an extent in order to try to, you know, justify them in order to stay in the White House.
I think he could. And that's one of those things that, you know, we can... People can make fun of folks who, you know, that presidential alert text came out and, you know, everyone's just saying, well, you know, it's just for FEMA. It's just for disasters. You know, if there's some big disaster, shouldn't the president be able to talk to everyone? And I think, no, that's a really dangerous idea that one person has access to send a message to millions and millions and millions of Americans all at once. And we forget, we act as though, you know, the president loses all their authority after they lose an election. But there's still, you know, there's a transition period. There's 3 months. There's from November, so there's the month of November, December, and January, until like January 20th, when the inauguration happens. There's a big time period in there where you're a lame duck president. And what can you do in 3 months? What can you do in a week? What can you do in a day? When you have the authority and the ability to send a message to everyone, when you've been rallying up your base for years now, when we already see stuff like the Proud Boys out in the street being a, what is essentially a criminal gang. I wouldn't even call them a militia, because they aren't a militia. They aren't a organized paramilitary force. They are a street gang, is exactly what they are. They are not a militia like the Oath Keepers. They are a petty criminal street gang going out and beating people in the streets. And not only does Trump have that to bank on, not only does he have this street gang to bank on, he has the Oath Keepers, which are a militia force, which are organized in a hierarchical military-like fashion with military-style training. Of course, they build themselves as, you know, a veterans organization, and they've already publicly said, I keep saying this, and I'll keep saying it over and over again, because people can't forget. The Oath Keepers are training people to kill leftists. They are training people to hunt down and kill leftists, and they have offered their services to the president should he ever need it. And so, we have the beginnings of this. We exactly have the beginnings of what could be a very dark time for leftism in America, even worse than I would say in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, during this time of, you know, communist purging, of the Espionage Act after World War I, of the Red Scare in the 50s, I would argue we could be seeing even a worse time, because at least back then the FBI had to hide their actions. At least back then the FBI was doing covert actions and not to kill leftists, that it was still hidden from the public eye. Now they don't even have to rely on state institutions, because that is part of the fascist playbook. You have to not only take over the state, but build your own dual power. And this is what people forget. Dual power isn't just a leftist idea. Fascists employ this as well. Fascists use their own version of dual power to establish means outside of the state to take control of the state. The difference is that upon their seizing of the state, as we saw in Nazi Germany, as we saw in fascist Italy, they destroy their dual power, because that dual power becomes a threat to their institution. That dual power is not incorporated into the institution, or at least not in its entirety. Nazi Germany did this with their own paramilitary forces that they used to help facilitate their takeover of the German state, that many of them were either disavowed or straight up executed.
It does seem interesting. Today, the White House released a report on what they're calling the opportunity cost of socialism. basically, they tout all the old tired lies, the misunderstandings that the general public has about socialism and what that means. And they basically declared that, you know, these policies are completely unviable. And of course, you have the mainstream media like New York Times, Washington Post, yada, yada, you know, writing news articles about this report as if it's, you know, a concrete, you know, it's official, it's from the White House. Maybe we shouldn't even consider socialism. You know, it's just a way of planting the idea in people's minds. And I think it's interesting that, you know, you said that the Democratic Party isn't really putting forward any socialist candidates. So why is the White House so focused on putting down the socialist idea before it even has a political force behind it? It seems like they're either fearful of a socialist kind of mass movement as it's building. I mean, we do have DSA, they're more social democratic, but we do also have, in parallel, large numbers of people joining the Workers' World Party, PSL. You know, the Socialist Rifle Association is getting a lot of membership. I do wonder if the White House is worried about this, and if so, or if not, why then are they coming out with these reports, despite the fact that, at least in the mainstream, there is no political will for, say, the Democratic Party, which holds a majority of, you know, the left of center or the center-right political power. You know, no one's really promoting socialist ideas there.
Exactly. So why would they be afraid of this at this time? And I think, you know, we can try to read into that and we can try to, you know, almost push ourselves up to past the point where we are, that I do believe that we are in an era of renewed leftist energy and renewed leftist support, that all of these different leftist organizations are seeing big rises in their membership. The DSA, yes, they're still mostly social democratic, but there's a lot more radical ideology taking foot in there. And unlike the Democratic Party, the DSA is in a position where those more radical elements within it can push their motions and their agendas and push the DSA more and more to the left. Whereas in the Democratic Party, they have a very institutionalized power structure that resists that kind of change. Things with like these superdelegates, which they did the most barest of reforms of saying, well, now they can't pledge before the election. But they're still there when not even the Republican Party has superdelegates anymore, that the Republican Party did away with superdelegates. But here's the Democrats, this progressive, supposedly one per man, one vote party, keeping with these superdelegates with their extreme sway, like 700 superdelegates out of, I think, like 4,000 or 5,000 national votes. So that's almost a sixth of your voting power within the Democratic Party is held by these individuals who have the equivalent of thousands, tens of thousands of votes of the regular party member. So I don't know. We can try to say it's because we're getting big, and that would be both good and bad, because that would mean we're getting big enough to scare people, but bad enough that, you know, people are scared, and mostly these people in power are scared, and that doesn't go well for folks in our position. At the same time...
No, I agree completely. You know, the DSA is, I think, an actuator of some kind for fostering leftist thought. I was introduced to the DSA after I had already made the leap from anarchism to Marxist-Leninism. But when I started talking to people who were in DSA, I was talking to people who held ideologies that were at odds with what I was told DSA was. You know, it was very quickly introduced to other Marxist-Leninists. There was the Communist Caucus. So yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that DSA has a, you know, an entry-level kind of appeal, especially as it relates to maybe joining other parties or other socialist movements, socialist organizations, you know, even such as the SRA. Yeah, I just wonder to what extent the White House has socialism on its mind.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
That was absolutely bizarre. I don't know what happened. I think the fascists are actually coming for us now.
Yikes.
So, I guess we better...
Well, it's great to have you back.
Yes, so for the listeners, since I have no idea how I'm going to continue on from my previous thought because I've already forgotten about it, we had a strange technical glitch that cut out the stream, so...
I was talking about the DSA and rise in socialist movements and how it related to the White House report today.
Yeah, so I think what I was about to say was that basically we always have to be careful with the White House of how much it is the White House, how much it is the institution, you know, how much it is the staff within it, how much it is the administration, how much it is Trump himself. Honestly, I don't think Trump is afraid of anyone. Trump has nothing to fear. He is very wealthy. He is the most powerful man in the world. He literally has access to a nuclear arsenal, of all things. He doesn't have much to be afraid of. There's nothing for him to fear. But some of these people close to him, you know, they might have a job as a White House staff for a while, but eventually, you know, if Trump doesn't declare himself president for life, I mean, it's going to be the sort of thing that they're going to have future job prospects, basically, is what they're looking at. And if there is a moment in American history where the tide changes, and a leftist movement does take power, even if it is in its fledgling stages right now, even if it is only a fraction of what it used to be in the 1920s, in the 1930s, even if it is just a fraction of what it used to be, it's still enough to start something, to start change within the country. And certainly in the early 1900s, the elite, the politicians, the capitalists, they feared that very much just the same. And this idea that society might actually be transformed and that there might actually be a socialist movement in America that takes hold and makes changes and begins the transition of society into socialism, that's very frightening to these people. And I think
I think you're right. You know, I was going to say, a lot of people tend to view this idea of socialism being more palatable to millennials because of the distance between the Cold War. I don't think that's it. I mean, of course, millennials haven't been subjected to as intense propaganda as, say, the baby boomers. but the reality is older people are always, or at least for right now, I mean, the older people who really run this country, I mean, look at Congress. They're all really old dudes. You know, look at CEOs of major corporations. Look at the board of directors, that kind of thing. That's where all the real power lies in this country. So, of course, they're going to be opposed to socialism. You know, they have something to lose.
I would agree with your assessment that, you know, obviously the older generations are still very much influential in America, and they have a lot to lose in a socialist moment of history. And, you know, people, I think it's important for us to remember that people have sometimes a misconception, especially in the leftist community itself and, you know, outside of it with all this fear-mongering, that I do not think it's going to be that, you know, there's a leftist movement and they storm all the state capitals and a glorious revolution happens and society transitions. I don't buy into that. I don't support that notion. At the same time, I think people sometimes are very dichotomous in that view, that something I'll be discussing for the Patreon episode is this idea of electoral politics and how much reform is in there. And it, the DSA, of course, is very tied up in electoral politics. And I think people do see it as a dichotomy that either, oh, we either vote in a socialist government and social society changes, or it's 1917 and it's Russia and there's October Revolution. And that is
absolutely,
that's two extremes, but there is a middle ground there. There is different things that can happen.
Right. This is why, personally, I'm a huge fan of the PSL. Last year, or it might have been just earlier this year, my sense of time is very tenuous. They did the People's Congress of Resistance. So, you know, it's the very early stages of getting a bunch of Marxist-Leninists under the same roof, and really, you know, building a second Congress, you know, building the dual power. And I think this is the route going forward for leftists generally. If you don't have that dual power, then you really don't have the political will or momentum to establish a revolution by peaceful means or otherwise.
And I think this is an idea in one of those rare occasions, one of those truly rare occasions, that can unite leftists of all different colors and all different stripes, or of all different tendencies, that this idea of dual power, we all have our own ideas of how it's going down, and we all have our own ideas of how it's structured, but most leftists I've run into agree that dual power needs to be a thing. It needs to be out there in the world. It needs to be happening. And I think we can build a lot of unity across the different tendencies of saying, look, we don't all agree on the situation of government. We don't all agree on how these things are going to look after society has made its transformation. But we can agree that our current material conditions are shit. And we can agree that we need to improve it here in the now. And the answer to that is not fetishizing any of these events. It's not trying to look to the past and say, we're going to do exactly this, exactly the same way. It's not looking at, you know, 1917 gets a lot of flack, but I, from my own tendency, syndicalists tend to hold up the Paris strikes, the French strikes. It started in Paris, but it spread rapidly across France, that general strike in France, to the point where de Gaulle fled the country. He was so worried about a modern-day revolution in France. And these things arise from their circumstances. And no country's circumstance, no time period circumstance is exactly the same as another. And we can look to the past, and we must look to the past to learn from the mistakes of the past. But we cannot seek to emulate and maintain this notion going forward that somehow we're just going to pull everything off like it was before, and by just following this checklist of things to do, that's not how it's going to work. But dual power, that is a timeless concept. Dual power is a timeless concept that works in any community, in any time period. People appreciate those who help them as a society, as a people group, as a whatever. That if you come into somebody's community with food aid and water aid, and help them build their house, help them fix their house, help them get to a better situation in life, they appreciate that. And they're going to remember that. And that builds class consciousness versus, well, what we usually get, which is memeing on Twitter.
Yeah, I think dual power is going to be really important. You mentioned mutual aid, helping people after disasters, bringing in food and water and helping them rebuild. I think while that's very important, we also need to establish roles for people. We need to be able to have real organization to be able to vote on matters, bring issues forward, and make decisions outside of our governmental structure in a way that, like you said, raises class consciousness.
Yeah, and of course, these things need organization. It's not just something that, unfortunately, a lot of these folks who want to do good and want to help run into this exact problem, that how do we coordinate things? And it always requires some kind of structure. Even, I know people have different ideas of how things should be structured, and people have different ideas of how organizing should be done, and you know, what sort of positions should be inside of an organization. I get all that, and that's something people got to decide for themselves. At the same time, you still got to have focal points. You still got to have designated individuals of saying, even if you got to vote on every single one. You still got to have somebody designated to answer the phone. You still got to have somebody designated to drive the truck. People got to do individualized roles. This is how society functions. And so having an organization in place that can make those decisions and make those decisions quickly, you know, when it's a group of eight people, you know, if it's just a group of eight people, they can get that done pretty quick. It's easy to talk amongst yourselves when you can all fit in a large van. When you start getting into the hundreds, the thousands, the tens of thousands, or dare we even say the millions, well, of course, that's going to become more difficult to handle, which means you have to have greater levels of expediency. And any serious dual power structure that can help massive communities of the working class is going to be numbered in the millions. So that's something that we have to be aware of as well when we're organizing, that there has to be ways to make decisions, and there has to be ways to make decisions quickly when those decisions need to be made quickly. Well, this segment has just gone on for a while that I was not expecting this much good discussion to come out of, but this has been really, really good discussion that we've had. We could go on about this forever, I'm sure, and actually, I'd love to have a special episode, maybe with different people on, talking about dual power. I think dual power is one of these subjects that, you know, just so much can come out of it. So, it might be an idea for a Patreon episode here in the future of having different folks' views on how they would organize dual power. We will, however, transition out of this story for a little bit that... There's some news that I want to follow up on that I'd be remiss if we missed that. Following up on last week's episode of this story out of Turkey, this assassination, as it is, of the Washington Post journalist Khashoggi. I always get his name messed up for some reason, but I think I finally got it.
I heard it on NPR today. They were talking about this issue. They pronounced it Jamal Khashoggi.
Khashoggi.
The last G is like a J.
Okay.
The first G is pronounced like a regular G.
Okay. So this man, of course, we know for certainty now he is no longer with us. He was killed at the consulate, embassy, whichever it is. And the story, it just keeps on building on itself. Because, of course, last week we were talking about how Trump was defending the Saudi Arabian royal family and saying how he trusted the crown prince's story and how he didn't think the king had anything to do with it and this and that and the other. And the Saudi Arabians were up to story 7 at that point of what happened. And now the Turkish authorities have released video camera footage, CCTV footage, of a body double that the Saudi Arabian agents had put in place, that they had a body double of this journalist so that people would think that he was still alive and he was walking out the back exit, like the Saudi Arabians initially said he did, that he walked out the back exit. And they had this body double in place to do that story. And the Saudi Arabian government has now admitted to this. They admitted that they had that body double because the evidence is just too much for them to deny. It's just silliness as to how much they have tried to deny it, though. But now they've reached a new level of denial, because now they're saying there were definitely Saudi Arabian agents there, but we had no knowledge of what was going on. They're pulling the old Ronald Reagan, that when your intelligence services mess up, that you just claim ignorance. I didn't know what was going on. My memory's bad. So...
There were initial reports that the only reason that Jamal Khashoggi had been blacklisted was because he had reported some negative things on Trump. The only reason that the Saudis viewed him negatively was because of some reporting that he had done that portrayed Trump in a negative light.
Yes, this is actually something that I haven't done too much research into. I need to do some more, but I have heard things on the news feed about Jared Kushner designated Khashoggi this as a person of interest. And certainly if Jared Kushner is responsible for this man's death, then that is, I don't know. I would say that should elicit a response, but at the same time I feel conflicted, because of course this is a very tragic, very horrific circumstance. This man was brutally tortured and executed in the name of preserving a ancient form of government that has no right to exist anymore, and in the name of because he insulted a leader of a Western country that supposedly has a more modern form of government, and yet here we are making backroom deals apparently to have journalists knocked off. I'm conflicted on this because I feel like this should elicit serious response. At the same time, I must remind listeners, the war in Yemen continues. The Saudi Arabian government continues a brutal campaign in Yemen. Thousands have died. Thousands more, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are without infrastructure. Infrastructure has been ruined, destroyed. Access to clean drinking water is continuing to decline. Sanitary conditions are continuing to worsen. This is a very serious situation in Yemen. And here we are, apparently what it takes to get the attention of the Western media. Now, of course, the Washington Post. And this is what I will, I can rag on these fascists and, Trump and the White House administration all day long. But they're fascists. They are right-leaning, conservative forces. I don't know what my cat's doing back there, but these are very conservative, very right-leaning, oftentimes either neo-fascist or just straight-up fascist individuals. And so, of course, that's their ideology. This is their ideology. It's a terrible, reactionary, disgusting ideology. But it is their ideology, and some of them at least make some effort to maintain consistency with their terribleness. But let's look at the Washington Post. Mr. Khashoggi was part of the Washington Post. And the Washington Post, previously, their board of editors or whatever, had endorsed the war in Yemen. Or I don't think it was technically an endorsement, but they apologized a lot for the U.S.'s involvement. They said that it was a more complex story, and they congratulated the U.S. for providing food aid. Even as we send $100 billion worth of arms to the Saudi Arabian government, because we sent a couple million dollars worth of cereal grain, well, that makes everything even. Even as people's country are bombed back to the Stone Age, this supposedly makes it even. But now that one of their own has been brutally executed, now they are against this war. And I can at least give some tacit modicum of, not respect, respect is not the right word, but understanding. If you have a terrible idea and you stick to it, well, you're a terrible person, and you shouldn't stick to your terrible ideas. We should all grow and develop. But at least if you're consistent, that's something you've got going for yourself. Whereas these folks, they weren't moved by the plight of the citizens and residents of Yemen that are having their lives destroyed and their homes destroyed. They were moved because one of their own died. And it is shameful to me that this is what it takes for these so-called investigative journalists to be moved, is because one of their own has been killed, and not because they can go out into the world, that these are elite Western, basically petite bourgeoisie journalists who could go out to this war zone, who could go out and see the devastation, and they turn a blind eye until it is inconvenient for them because the forces that are orchestrating this war have now turned against them.
Yeah, I mentioned I was listening to NPR earlier, and it became obvious how disconnected they are from the reality of the situation. So, I didn't hear any mention of Yemen, but more bizarrely, they had someone on, couldn't remember his name, couldn't remember what role he has in society, but the woman who was conducting the news segment was interviewing him and getting his opinion on things. And she asked if the United States should push for regime change in Saudi Arabia as a response. Now, what I found so strange about this question was because of Saudi Arabia's very interesting role that it has with the United States. So I don't know if you're aware of this, but in 1974, the Nixon administration was trying to figure out how to never, ever have an oil crisis in the United States ever again. So Nixon sends his CIA agents and some top cabinet officials to Saudi Arabia, and they work out a deal. And what they established was that if the Saudis would accept payments for their oil in United States dollars only, the United States would forever give Saudi Arabia as many weapons as it needs, secure its borders, make sure that Saudi Arabia stays safe, assist it in any wars that it needs to wage. And in return, Saudi Arabia was expected to take those U.S. those U.S. dollars that it received as payments for its oil and invest it into U.S. Treasury bonds. This would do a couple things. It would ensure that the United States would always have a supply of oil with an OPEC nation. It would ensure that their economy was, you know, going to be on the rise forever. It established the United States as the oil reserve currency. Saudi Arabia and the United States are inextricably linked. And the failure of analysis that I'm hearing from the mainstream media is appalling, because no one seems to be bringing this up. The United States is complicit in all of the things that Saudi Arabia's done. You know, the entire, you know, monarchy that they have there. I mean, they still do public beheadings as punishments for crimes. They chop people's hands off. You know, they're basically ISIS, but they have all this power because we give it to them. We allow it to a court. You know, we're very complicit in that situation. It seems like liberal media is totally unaware of this, which couldn't be true. They have to know this. You know, they're academics who are aware of the, you know, geopolitics of the world. It just seems like they're doing a disservice to the American public by omitting this information.
Absolutely. The history of Saudi Arabia and America and that deal Nixon made, it is something that we could go on for hours about, and probably I'll toss it on the wish list of things to talk about in a dedicated role for things like those specialized episodes where we can give topics like that more justice and more research. And yes, it is the sort of thing that if regime change is not the correct answer, of course, because we've seen how regime changes happen before. Now, this is one of the things that people will say, well, should we never speak out against a foreign country? And of course not. I do that all the time on this podcast. If somebody has a bad idea, them not being in your backyard doesn't mean you can't say that their idea is bad. What we must be careful about, though, is we cannot advocate for something like regime change because we know what would happen if it were to take place, that America would do what it has always done, and that is just replace it with a more compliant government. Except that the U.S. has no reason to do this at this time. The only reason this has come up is because of the public outrage around this. That, unfortunately, it is true that one death is a tragedy and a million is a statistic. That people abstract away these big ideas and these big numbers, and it's just something that's in the background. But one person you can relate to, one person's struggle you can relate to, and therefore it is more deeply impactful. It's the U.S. government has no reason to do a regime change because the Saudi Arabian regime is already what everything the U.S. government could ask for. It is a military ally. It provides the U.S. with a cheap source of oil and a steady source of oil. It provides, you know, this $100 billion arms sale generates, as the Republicans love to point out, it generates thousands of jobs back here in America. Thousands of skilled labor jobs go into building the missiles that kill Yemeni children. It's one of those things, though, that it becomes, in a capitalist society like this, of course the point is that it's $100 billion. Of course the point in a capitalist society is that there's $100 billion being spent and there's all these jobs. And it's not the point that the job is literally going towards a backwards regime that belongs back in the feudal era, that, as you said, performs these very, very obscene things like chopping people's hands off, that practices that have no place in the modern day. Certainly, we all have our different views on execution. I don't think beheading is a good technique, though. It's one of those things that capitalism says we have spent money and we have created jobs, and therefore that is good. Whereas a socialist system must and does ask, where is that money going to? Why are we doing this? Because I guarantee you that, yeah, that specific job might not exist if we weren't building missiles and planes to sell to the Saudi Arabian government. That specific job might not exist. But that opportunity cost, you know, the White House can release the report about the opportunity cost of socialism. But that opportunity cost of capitalism, that money has gone into building a missile that will go and cause destruction across the world, that opportunity cost was used to make that missile. If it hadn't been used to do that...
Speaking of missiles, you know, it's strange to me that no one has... sorry for interrupting, but it's just strange to me that we're having this conversation now and not in 2001, when Saudi Arabia very clearly orchestrated large aspects of the 9/11 terror attacks.
Absolutely. And this is something I'll remind people again. Congress passed a rule, a law, allowing American citizens to sue the Saudi Arabian government because we recognize their role. But where is the outrage? And what has happened is that it is a prime example of how capitalist society works. Capitalism wants this to happen. Capitalism needs this to happen because it is a purchaser. The Saudi Arabian royals are sitting on trillions of dollars worth of oil, a massive oil reserve that will bring them prosperity for the royal family for decades, maybe even centuries, depending on how, you know, if oil use goes down, continue into the future with electric cars or something like that, which I don't really buy into. But capitalism and the capitalist class are completely okay with Saudi Arabia, so long as it fits their purposes. And if their purposes is to extract wealth and enrich themselves, then they will not allow public opinion to go in such a way that threatens that lucrative business deal. And we've seen this time and time again. We can talk about this, or we can talk about back in the 80s, or the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, when tobacco companies were paying off doctors to say that, oh, smoking is good for you. Smoking is actually really good for you guys. Trust us. And they paid off doctors to do it. Anytime something threatens their bottom line, they will try. They even did this with lead and gasoline. One of the chief executives, I think of GM, washed his hands in lead-enriched gasoline to prove a point. He uncoincidentally later developed complications from lead poisoning. Things like this are just, it's examples of how the capitalist class exerts their influence on society. Why aren't we outraged that Saudi Arabia had a very large role in orchestrating 9/11 and causing the deaths of thousands of residents here in the United States? Why aren't we outraged about that? And the answer is...
Yeah, and just as an addendum to that, when Congress vetoed Obama's veto of the bill that would allow U.S. citizens to sue Saudi Arabia over 9/11, Saudi Arabia then threatened to sell nearly $1 trillion of U.S. treasury bonds. The United States assets that it owns, that it has been accumulating over the years to the United States' benefit, if the United States allowed these cases to continue. So I think there were around 25 cases, and it doesn't look like those are going to go forward now.
Yeah, it is. We have tied our hands on this, and if we do ever get to the point where we can divorce ourselves of this arrangement, it will hurt. And that is what will happen. It will hurt, and it will hurt dearly. We could see the return of oil shortages and gas lines if we did that, if we lost Saudi Arabia as a trade partner. But it is the question of how much can society endure to make a better change? How much can society endure for a short time that it would take to switch us from Saudi Arabia to something else, be it our own domestic reserves, be it another trading partner, be it an entire infrastructure change? And how much does it take for society to actually make that decision versus saying, well, you know, it sucks that women, men, women, children are dying in Yemen, but at least we can put gas in our cars for $3 a gallon, and I guess this is okay because of that.
Yeah, one must wonder how deeply in bed the conservative politicians who have for, you know, decades been against renewable energy, you know, how deeply involved they are with the Saudis. Seems like that's really been the only major, blockade to switching to renewable energy. You know, meanwhile, socialist China is pumping out solar panels like hotcakes. And, you know, I think they're on a real track to be completely independent from OPEC in the near future. So, you know, that's definitely the route we should have been taking all this time. But because capitalism is so embroiled in the dictatorship of capital, our politicians have just not allowed that kind of development to occur.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot to be said on this topic, and I have plenty more to say on it myself, and I do think that's as good of any point to kind of move on from this. Certainly, I'll include plenty of links in the show notes for people to do continuing research and develop their opinions on what's going on here, and I'll try to include some links as well regarding that Nixon-era deal about and what's tied us to Saudi Arabia since the 70s. We will, however, journey back home. We will come back home from this foreign expedition, and we will come back home to see what the Trump administration is up to again. And unfortunately, it is nothing good, as usual. It is to do with our transgender comrades, that the transgender community is under attack once again, this time by the federal government, by the Department of Health, that they are seeking to define the condition of being transgender out of existence, that they will, at the federal level, to be adopted by all other federal agencies after the Department of Health passes through this, a definition that says your biological sex and your gender is defined by your chromosomes. So, of course, as we learned in elementary biology, biologically female individuals have XX, biologically male individuals have XY. And of course, that's what you're taught in elementary school. And then when you get older and you can be taught further complex things, you find out things aren't as simple as that. There's a lot of variation that goes on with that. There's instances where people have multiple chromosomes. There's people who only have one, actually. That sometimes happens. Sometimes there's one, sometimes there's three, sometimes there's even four. There's a lot of weird stuff that can go on with your genes. Genes are weird in general. But the Trump administration, you know, operating on this elementary school level of sex ed education, is seeking to push this through. And this is, I am sure, coming from our Vice President Mike Pence, who is famously, infamously against LGBT rights, passing all sorts of discriminatory measures in his home state before he became vice president. And lest I have to remind everyone that if the Democrats somehow pull some sort of Hail Mary and impeach Trump, that is who we get to replace him. And if Trump is enabling the fascists, well, just you wait until Pence is enabling the Dominionists. That's going to be real fun. Fascists by another name, essentially, at that point. But this is, I'm sure, coming from Pence. I'm sure Pence has been speaking in people's ears about this. And it is, of course, outrageous. It would cause all sorts of administrative issues with transgender individuals. For instance, on passports, you would have the government would not recognize reassignment surgery or hormone therapy or anything of that to change your birth sex, as they are referring to it. They recognize no change to it. It specifically in their definition would be immutable, and that any discrepancies or any questions would be solved by a DNA test. And of course, hormone therapy, reassignment surgery, these things do not change your chromosomes. We do not have the mechanisms to change genes at that scale quite yet, if ever.
So obviously political as well. There's no logical or, you know, there's no real reason to be doing this. It's so clearly virtue signaling to their extremely conservative base. Yeah, it's just absolutely bizarre.
Absolutely. And it really puts me out there that, of course, we all know we all have transgender comrades. We all know that this is a community that has suffered so much throughout the years. And for a brief moment, you know, America, it hasn't made as much progress as it should on this issue. There's still a lot of fights to be had, but it looked like at least we are on course to get better, that things were getting better, and it looked like things were going to continue to get better. And now we are sliding back. We are sliding back. And, you know, something I've been pointing out in, you know, Wichita DSA chat and stuff, as this has come out, and of course many members in the Wichita DSA are transgender themselves, something I've been pointing out is that an example of a nation that did wrong but has made up for it, that no nation is perfect, no history is perfect, but we are not judged by the history but what we do in response to the history. And a nation that has a very poor history with the LGBT community but has made great strides to repair the mistakes of the past is Cuba. That Cuba has very excellent programs for transgender individuals now. They actually have reassignment surgery and hormone therapy offered through their state healthcare service. It's a remarkable thing, and it's been offered there since 2008. And lest I need to remind anyone, in 2008, during the Democratic primaries, we had Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and both of them were against same-sex marriage. Now, they weren't as vehemently against it as, say, their Republican counterparts, but they were still against it. They still said they had their reservations. They still said marriage was between a man and a woman. And they did not have good opinions on the transgender community either. It didn't really come up because so often the community is simply overlooked. But it's something that America has a great deal of progress to make on this. And certainly we can look to an example of a nation like Cuba that has had a bad history of it, that did persecute the LGBT community during its history, but has since then owned up to the mistakes of its past. Castro, before he died, realized the mistake he had made and talked about it in public. And the government of Cuba is continuing to push forward to fix these mistakes. And meanwhile, America is seeking to create a definition that doesn't even make biological sense. This definition includes nothing of people with not usual chromosomal arrangements. It's outrageous, and I don't even know. I have so many thoughts on it, but I don't know if I have so many words on it.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel for everyone who's going to be, you know, running into issues. I imagine that, yeah, like you said, with passports and so many other government documents, if you're presenting one gender and the government will refuse to recognize that, you may have issues with, you know, government documents, getting things approved. And, you know, it's just an unnecessary, dehumanizing kind of complicated process that transgender folk are going to have to deal with because of this. I mean, honestly, it's disgusting.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, this is a departmental thing, so this is the Department of Health. I'm not a big one to say, go write your congressperson and see if they can do something. You know, that's not always the best option. But this is something that, if it makes people feel any better, do more than that. You know, write a letter, but do more than that. Go speak out. Go join a group. Go join with comrades who can look out for each other, who can keep each other safe, who can help each other if and when the legal system and the state comes down to only further the oppression that society currently puts against these individuals. I'd say be active. There is, you know, Eugene Debs said that there is no Messiah coming to save us all. There is no progressive Democratic candidate that's just going to change the course of history and, you know, usher in a new era of civil rights. There is no Messiah to lead people out of the desert. It is something that you have to lead yourself out of the desert. And more than that, you and your fellow workers and your comrades lead yourselves out of the desert together as a collective force. And it is much harder for the state, and sometimes impossible for the state, to oppress a group of people when they have come together and they have formed a class consciousness amongst themselves, and they work in unison to protect each other, too, in all manners, that be that, you know, self-defense against people who, you know, there's been plenty of attacks on the transgender community by private individuals, oftentimes the not pursued as heavily or at all by the state authorities. So you got to be able to protect yourself against, you know, just regular private individuals coming after you, as well as state actions. And when there is big mobilized blocks, you know, the liberal thing is, well, big mobilized blocks vote and vote these people out. But in actuality, big movements and big blocks of people make change happen because it worries politicians, not because they're going to lose their job necessarily, but because they realize that the state exists because the people of the state allow it to exist. That is how America likes to think of itself, at least. And if you have a large group of people that says, hey, we're not really satisfied with how things are going, change happens because if there's one thing these people care about more than anything else, it's being able to cling to some minuscule amount of power just so they can have some power.
I don't really have anything to add. I think that was well said.
Well, I think we will transition into the final topic of the night, and as is now par for the course for the podcast, with our final story of the night, we will have a brief intermission to discuss how this podcast is made and how this podcast is developed and made possible by viewers such as yourself. As many, I'm sure, are now aware, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/socialistrapodcast. I felt worth reiterating because I think there's been some confusion in recent days, especially now that I have a more formal role in the organization. This continues to be an independent cut podcast. I license the name from the organization, but the organization does not curate the content. Of course, members of the organization are guests on this podcast, but I am actually in process of getting some big name names for the guest list that are not from the organization. We're now getting to that point of size and scale of the podcast, but this is not, you know, officially part of the SRA Bible, I guess. This is still a personal endeavor on my part, and that Patreon is the compensation I receive for doing this, which is how the way I like it. I prefer it this way. It gives me latitude to talk about what I want, when I want, how I want. So if you support the podcast and you want to see more podcasts like it, or more episodes coming out of better and better quality, you can go to Patreon. It's $5 a month starting out, if you have the funds and are willing to do that. It's always greatly appreciated. We just hit $100 a month, which, you know, is small, but it's still significant, still a power of 10, and it's appreciated. It's like a month's worth of food for me now. I can make $100 stretch for food for a month, so we will get out of this, and we'll go straight into the last topic of the night, which is Washington Initiative 1639. It is a state petition initiative that will be going on the ballot this November, and basically it's increasing the rules on firearms sold in the state of Washington. So it will do things such as increasing the age of all firearms to 21, I believe, and then increasing the background checks, putting a waiting period in place for the sale of firearms, and then also adding safe storage laws to the books. So this is interesting because, I mean, other states have enacted things of this nature, but this would put it in one of the strictest gun regimes in America. And it was interesting to me as well that in a kind of odd moment of disunity, so often gun control measures are supported by these police organizations. We've talked about it previously on the show. And it seems like there's a split this time around because the Chief Law Enforcement Officers Associations in the state of Washington threw their support behind the measure, but the police unions of the state of Washington have actually decried the measure and thrown their support against it. And it's an interesting thing to me of seeing this split, because in a rare instance of these things, I've been trying to research why this is the case, because I don't buy into the story that, oh, you know, the street cops believe in your rights, but those dirty administrative cops don't believe in your rights. I don't buy that story one bit. I wonder how much it is because these laws affect everyone, that there is no exemption carved out in these laws for law enforcement officers. At the same time, nothing in here seems like it would be particularly hard for a law enforcement officer or increase the burdens on a law enforcement officer in any sort of significant way. So what if a cop's got to wait extra couple days to buy a gun? That's not the cops already have guns. That doesn't really affect them. The only thing I could really come up with was maybe the safe storage rules, because it doesn't really provide an exemption in any sort of way for a weapon kept on you for self-defense. So, you know, of course, cops tend to be in a situation that they want to have their guns out and ready to go. And, you know, I think that's a not necessarily, you know, something that only cops do, of course. A gun is useless in a self-defense scenario if it takes you 15 seconds to open up your safe and pop it out and get your ammunition from the other side of the house, because your state legislature has decided your ammunition needs to be stored so many feet away from the gun. Things like that, that affects everyone. And I wonder if, you know, these street cops don't want to be affected by that, or if there's something else going on.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the storage requirements. That's going to be familiar to anyone who lives in Europe. But, you know, I don't know if there's many states that do this. The storage requirement's interesting. We always hear after mass shootings, school shootings, that kind of thing, about waiting periods and background checks. But the storage requirements are definitely interesting. Yeah, I have to agree. If you're in a situation where you need to defend yourself for whatever reason in your own home, it does not behoove you to have to go into your safe, open that up, and like you said, grab the ammunition. You know, most people who are gun-owning and feel like, you know, they're in a situation where they're going to need to use a pistol or whatever, you know, they've got their place that they keep their gun, you know, that they know that they can get to in a relatively quick manner. I don't see how that, yeah, this seems like an infringement of some kind. I mean, it's definitely an infringement on those who are in a situation where they're going to need to defend themselves. But it also seems like one of those things that you would expect more debate on. I've come to expect the background checks, the waiting periods, and, you know, after the Parkland shooting, when Florida raised its age to 21, you know, that's something we've come to expect. The storage requirements are particularly interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, don't take this the wrong way, listeners, that you have to analyze things based on your situation, that every situation is going to be different, and you have to practice common sense. The problem with these laws is that it applies a single situation to everyone. The thing is, for individuals, everyone's got to have their own individual situation. For instance, if you have children in your household, don't leave loaded guns around. Don't leave guns in places that children can access. This is rule number one of responsible gun ownership. If you have children, do not put your gun in a place where a child can access it, and do not leave it loaded. This is an absolute must. At the same time, not everyone has children. Not everyone is in that situation. If you live alone, and If you live alone, you might have more reason to be concerned for your safety because, as we know, two is one and one is none. If you're in that sort of situation, you live alone, you don't have the folks coming around all the time, then you can change that. You don't have to adhere to the same rules, but you still have to be responsible because we are a forgetful people. And if you have a guest over and, you know, the guest isn't aware and then they stumble upon your gun, things could happen. Not good things. So always be smart about how you do this. And I don't say that people can't have safes. There are safes out there designed for quick access. There's safes they make for, I know there's like nightstand safes that they make underneath your nightstand and it bolts in there. There's like a fingerprint sensor in there and it can pop out. They make trigger blocks where you have to put your finger against the fingerprint sensor to unlock the trigger and pull it back. There's things that they make. And I'm not the biggest proponent of trigger locks because I feel like that's just one more place of failure. At the same time, you got to weigh, it's all cost benefits. What's the cost and what's the benefit? And you gotta weigh those decisions, and you gotta weigh the probability of if the day ever comes when I use this, is that possibility worth this other possibility that something wrong is going to happen? So you have to be a responsible gun owner, and let us not pretend that this is something saying that you don't have to be. You have to be a responsible gun owner, and you have to be responsible about how you store your guns. But this is a fluid, dynamic situation that a state law can't possibly account for all these different scenarios that would require slightly different storage requirements.
One of the more interesting aspects of the storage requirements is that they shift liability. So the exact wording here in the law is you may face criminal prosecution if you store or leave an unsecured firearm where a person who is prohibited from possessing firearms can and does obtain possession. You could actually be charged with a Class C felony, community endangerment, or also charged up to $250 for being in violation of this. So if you are renting an apartment with another roommate and they're a felon but you're not, because of their legal status, your rights are infringed upon, and you could be a felon just for living with them.
Which, by the way, that 250 number is actually a separate thing. That the $250 fine is for a civil infraction for gun store owners to put a sign up stating that law. So the $250 fine is for the gun owners, whereas the Class C felony is for somebody who has their gun possessed by another individual who is not supposed to have it. Which we already see this in other states, but just not in the law. For instance, in Kansas, there's a lot of stuff you do if your gun is stolen, for instance. There's some liability that can come back on you for that if your stolen gun is then used in a crime. It's a lot of stuff to do with civil court, and civil court is just this legal black hole. But the Kansas does provide some immunity if you do your due diligence, if you report your gun is stolen, if you made sure you had some kind of effort to make sure it wasn't taken. And that's usually a pretty low bar to handle. But you can still be sued, at least in civil court, over it. Whereas, of course, in this situation, you are becoming criminally liable. It's an interesting thing, and I cannot support storage laws that make this blanket statement, basically, of saying either you make sure your gun is impossible to access, or if it ever is accessed, then you're going to be a criminal now. That's not how things should work. You should do your due diligence, but like so many things in life, you're expected to do your due diligence without having the state come in and tell you exactly how to do your due diligence. That there needs to be guidelines, but that's something that we have to take as responsible citizens and not be a situation where we have to have it mandated and enforced upon us. Otherwise you get into situations like this where you have a blanket law that covers too much.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand the situation where, you know, you have a child that is in a home where people do not take gun safety very seriously, and unfortunately someone dies. However, you know, you can't you can't enforce these edge cases on everyone. You know, the presumed guilt that is assumed to be just waiting to happen seems a little odd, especially if it infringes on other people's rights to their own self-defense. Hopefully we'll get, you know, some repudiation of these kinds of tactics from the states. And I don't know, I just feel like there should be a greater public outcry.
I don't know. It's one of those things, we can keep an eye on it. We'll see how it goes. I haven't read too much opinion polling on it, but certainly there seems to be a lot of folks coming out on either side of it to try to, for the yes and the no. So we'll see how it goes. I think it's just, my main takeaway from it is, guys, be responsible gun owners, because the more irresponsible gun owners there are, the more the public sees this, and the more the public is swayed by this idea that the state must come in and enforce its will to protect the public against people who are irresponsible with their guns. Don't be irresponsible. If you see somebody being irresponsible, call them out on it. Guns are very powerful, very dangerous tools, and it's like people have this idea that, you know, I've run into it, that people think it's rude to talk to somebody else about how their gun is stored or something. You know, you walk into somebody's house and the shotgun is just sitting there propped up next to the door, and it's one of those things that you should call them out. You should talk to them, and you should say, "Hey, you got to be better." I mean, if I was walking down the street and I saw somebody chainsawing a log and their arm was underneath the log about to get chainsawed, I would go and tell them. I'd say, "Hey, that's not good practice, man. Don't do that. Don't cut your arm off." In the same way, guns. Yeah, the difference is guns, they don't have really warning signs. You can't see it coming in advance. They are things that happen in an instant, and people die. So we gotta be good comrades. We gotta make sure that our friends and our fellow comrades are being responsible with their guns just as much as we are making sure that we are being responsible with them as well ourselves. Well, with that, we will draw the episode to a close. Lots of good discussion tonight. Really good discussion that I liked. As far as people who wish to maybe follow up with the episode, where would be a good place to contact you, Jay?
I'm hanging out on Twitter. I am Absinthol on Twitter. It's Absinthol. Where else? Yeah, that's pretty much it. I do a lot of the web work for the SRA. I am recently elected secretary of the new 501c4. So I'll be around.
Alrighty. And as always, I can be found at HumvaDev on Twitter, as well as many other sources that will be in the show notes. So thank you much for returning to the show and offering your insights, Jay. And hopefully we will do this once again into the future.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And remember, listeners, seize the means of production.